Hello, and welcome to the Path of Power with Galexis. My name is Ginger, and I channel Galexis. Now, Galexis is a group of beings from many places, levels, dimensions. I really don't know the constituency of this whole group, but they do speak as one through me, and they've been doing that since August of 1988. So what we are having here is a 21st year anniversary. So welcome to the show. We are back from our vacation, so today it is live. You're not listening to recording. So anyway, before I get out of the way and Galexis comes to be with you, I just want to mention, if you're not acquainted with Galexis, please check out our website, galexisspirit.com. That's galexisspirit.com. The Path of Power radio show is every first and third Monday, so next week we'll be Tall Cat Psychic in this very same time spot. Now, if you go to the website, feel free to sign up for our free newsletter and check out the calendar workshops we have coming up the Wednesday nights in the L.A. area are coming up, and there's also going to be a workshop in September. All the details are there. And so now I'm going to head into trance, and Galexis will be with you shortly, and they'll present a message, and then you can call in with your questions on any topic, okay? And feel free always to give us feedback on the show. Write us at galexisspirit.com and let us know if there's anything you would suggest we do differently or a new format. Add or subtract anything, just let us know whatever you feel and whatever you think. And, of course, we always love wonderful testimonials and appreciation. So, anyway, I'm going to get out of the way. I'm going to be quiet for a few seconds. So goodbye until next time from me. And in a few seconds of quiet, nobody's going away, the show's not going to end, I'll just be very quiet. And you may hear me breathing a little bit, and then Galexis will be with you. So have a great one, and so I'll talk to you next time. All right, we are here. We are Galexis. Welcome. Welcome. Today we're going to talk about living multidimensionally. Now, you already do live multidimensionally, but you take it as a matter of fact. You take it for granted. You're living in three-dimensional reality all the time. It's totally common for you to think in terms of length, width, height. You think about the box. It's a three-dimensional box, in a sense. When you get the length and the width and the height, you got a dimensional box. Now, most people think and live within the box. Every time you grow, you break out of the box. Every time you expand your consciousness, you break and bust the box, and you're in new territory. And you rebuild and create a new box. You see, you wouldn't feel comfortable to function without one. But in order for you to live multidimensionally beyond a 3D context, to work with and function with fifth dimension, sixth dimension, and others, you've got to realize that you've got to bust out of this box, and it's got to be big enough, expanded enough, to give you more flexibility, to give you more freedom, to slip around, to move around, and to stretch boundaries over here, stretch the boundaries over there, and stretch the boundaries over there, and slip outside of the box and come back in, and slip outside of the box and come back in. Now you may say, Galexis, why would I want to come back in? Well, frankly, dear one, if you don't stay in your box more often than not, you lose your orientation. So you have a whole structure of beliefs and mythology and all sorts of wondrous complexes of emotions and thoughts and so forth. You have history, you have projections, you have your desires, and all those kinds of things are in a context of your daily life. And that, in and of itself, is the manifestation that you are experiencing on the physical plane of all the things that you're creating. But you slip outside of the box to get a greater perspective. Now, one of the reasons we decided as a group, as individuals within our group, to not work in the physical plane at this time was because we wanted to assist all of those who were willing to work at creating and changing the paradigm of consciousness on the planet, who want to participate in the great shift. And we want to assist those of you who are doing that groundbreaking, amazing kind of trailblazing work by giving you and providing for you a reference point that's outside your box. You don't tend to think consistently outside the box. You can slip out here and there. You can bust the box and expand the box. But in order to really work with fourth and fifth, sixth dimension, you need to slip outside the box, experience something that may be totally disorienting to you, and bring it back into the box. And then you work with it. You can go outside the box and dream and get a higher perspective, kind of come and play with us, and then go back into the box and manifest it. Now, there's several ways to do that, and we're going to make a suggestion of a couple. The first one is we would suggest to enable you to lose this sense of imprisonment in your box, to be able to slip out there and explore those places beyond time and space. We would suggest that you start looking at what's inside the box, your 3D manifestation that is going on, things that you think are real and solid and truly happening. The people that are with you, the things that are around you, all those things that are important to you, your physical body, all of those things, part to see that as an illusion. It's part of an illusion. It's a part of a dream that you're dreaming. A greater you, let's imagine that a greater you is going to sleep at night and has a dream, and in this dream is dreaming you, the one that is functioning on the mundane level in your box. If you can imagine during your day just to pause and just let your mind expand and just say, okay, this is all some kind of a dream. This is no different from my night dreams. Just think about it. Look at things. What if this was really ephemeral? What if it was all just a kind of a made-up, imaginary illusion? What if it were just a movie using three dimensionals rather than two dimensions as your movies do at this time? First step is to soften the boundaries of your box by doing this. Now, there are times when you've had perceptions that don't fit in your ordinary day. And what most of you do is when you have one of those, you quickly deny that it existed. But you see, if you start thinking about it's a dream, then what will happen is that you'll be able to see some of these things that are happening that you often pick up, but that you miss. Things like being able to look at something and to go up really close and look at it for a minute, even though you're 50 feet away, to get that perspective as if you're right up close and all of a sudden you realize I'm 50 feet away. It's only in your night dreams that you can say, I'm curious about this, and you zoom in and you're there. That's the way things function on the other levels. That's the way they function in fourth dimension, time-space. That's the way they function in fifth dimension, which is imagination. And that's the way they function in sixth and seventh dimension, chaos and creativity and magic. All of those things are in these greater dimensions. And if you also think about what is here in the box as illusion, and that as you gain dimensionality, it's like you're getting more pieces of the puzzle. So it fills in a greater picture. It makes it fills in more of the pictures of the greater reality. And therefore, that magic and creativity and imagination are really more authentic, more real, more true than what you see in two and three dimensions. Just think about it during the day. That's one thing that we would suggest. A second thing would be in meditation, to allow yourself to take astral flight. Now, you may not know how to get out of your body fully and fly in the astral plane. You may not know all those techniques. You don't need to. You use it in your imagination. You pretend that you lift out of your body and you float away. And you give yourself something to think about, to perceive, to explore that might be interesting. You know, I think I'd like to go and explore a great, you know, primeval forest somewhere. Well, there's hardly any primeval forest left on the planet. There's some down in Australia. There's a little bit left in California. And there's some left on the northeast coast of the United States. And there's a few other places. There's a spot somewhere up in Great Britain, and here and there, you can find them. Canada has a few spots, but some majestic, grand, phenomenal forest. Just let yourself just slip out of your body and in your imagination go into this forest. And just like in a Disney movie, talk to the animals there. See nature spirits. Maybe fairy beings will be there. Play. Pretend. Make something up. You probably haven't done this since you were a child. When you do that, you're stretching out of the box. Now, after you do that for a while and you play around with it, don't, and also we want to say, don't edit it and don't judge it. Just pretend. Just make stuff up. Just see if you can make the wildest, most imaginative stuff up. Just give yourself a stretch. Give yourself a grow. And then, once you've done that, then allow yourself to turn back to your reality and look at a little issue that you may have, a decision that you, let's say, that you have to make. Now, don't look first thing at your, you know, major life-changing decision. Should I marry this person? I've got to move, or shall I let my company go bankrupt or whatever? You know, no major one. Just find a smaller one and just go for that and just look at it. And from this place of your imagination, see if you get any insights that you didn't have before about it. You're coming back to it from a grander perspective. We would suggest this is just a first step to living dimensionally as a conscious being. Now, know that all these dimensions are operative in you at all given times. So you're not going anywhere. You're still in you. You are made up of all these dimensions. All right, dear one. So at this time, we would like to open it up, open up the phone lines if you want to give us a call. Here are some numbers you can call. It's 888-815-9756. and that's a toll-free number, of course, or you can call 530-776-5185. All right. Do we have a caller already? Okay. We just heard a click on the line. All right. So as we are waiting for you to give us a call, again, 888-815-9756 or 530-776-5185. We will continue our discussion about the other dimensions. Now, the universe that you're used to functions in the lower seven dimensions, mostly. That's where you work the most. And your universe is created of has several planes in it, several vibrational levels in it. And you, as a vibrational entity, are living in the physical plane, which is the lowest vibration of all of them. That means nothing about who you are. That does not say that you're some lowly pile of crap, all right? You're living on physical earth. You're living on the physical plane as a choice that you have made. And you voluntarily chose to reduce your perception of the other dimensions so that you could focus here and work here. You had to forget, for the most part, who you were. Now, when you were a young child, you might have still remembered. But at some point, the gate closed, somewhere between the age of 1 and 3 for most of you. A few of you, it remained later. Right? But we would say that by the age of 5, pretty much everyone is closed off. All right, so here we have a caller. Hello?
Hello. Hello, Galaxis. Thank you very much for taking my call.
You're certainly welcome, dear one. So what would you like to discuss today?
I had been listening to your podcast about the inner young adult, which has been very fabulous and powerful for me. And as it relates to what is going on right now with you talking about us being multidimensional beings,
yes.
I have a question that I'm hoping you can answer. I have been experiencing physical body pain, and a couple of other people that I know are experiencing body pains as well recently.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if it's related to this coming in and out of the box, as you call it, expanding awareness from 3D to multidimensional, because I noticed that as I ponder what's going on in my life or who I have defined myself to be, that as I mourn not being who I thought I was, that emotions come up and then some body pain releases.
Yes.
So is this part of letting go of my identity or identifying too much with this 3D person that I perceive myself to be?
All right. A lot of that is, absolutely. But what happens is that when you grow, when you expand yourself, when you expand your box, and you create a bigger box, what you're really doing is taking back all the dimensionality that is yours, gradually, piece by piece, because that expanded space was space that previously was a place you were not conscious of. And so you had stashed all sorts of stuff that you didn't want to deal with there. So when you expand, all the stuff that doesn't fit the vibration of the expanded new you must just come through and dump out in some way. Now, this doesn't mean that these are your limitations. This does not mean that you have to get stuck in a lot of arduous processing, or that there's a, you know, tremendous issues, or that you're not who you think you are or you're desiring to be. What it is that it's just stuff that doesn't fit you anymore. It doesn't match. It has to go. Now, there's several ways that this shows up. It can show up in the emotional body. And if it shows up in the emotional body, it can show up with a certain sense of anxiousness or dread Or it can show up in a tremendous restlessness or impatience that just seems to come out of the blue. The way it shows up often in the physical body, as you have pointed out, is pain. And most often we notice that the pain, it seems to be in the head. Now, the headaches that come with this, it's almost as if, yes, you literally have busted the lid of your box with your head. It's like you're pushed your envelope so much that what happens very often is in this snapback, once you've done some expansion, that you shut off your crown chakra a bit. And this creates pain throughout the body, but it can start in the head. Does that make any sense to you?
Makes sense with my friend who's had extremely painful migraines. I find my pains are more in the back of the side of my neck, and then my body feels stiff, as if I'm sitting. When you sit too long and you get up and it's hard to move, that's the kind of pain that I'm experiencing. More of an immobility.
All right. Well, the pain in your neck.
What you talked about is definitely what my friend was having, with these severe migraines where no medication would touch it.
Right. Well, we would suggest that if you don't feel the pain in your head, very often you'll feel it in your neck, because the poor neck has to keep the head up. It has to keep the whole body and the whole structure balanced. Right.
Right.
So we would suggest that that's in the same category, any pain that's in your neck. Okay, and also when you grow, neck and shoulders very often get a lot of pain. Now, the stiffness has to do with releases that are coming out of your body of stuff that you no longer need. It's coming out of your lymphatic system, and it's generally very acid, right? Now, your lymphatic system is the place on your physical body where you can stash old issues and old stuff. Your old identity is stuffed in there. So when it comes out, your lymphatic system has to do some extra work, and it has to do some extra draining. The thing is that the lymphatic system gets plugged up with acid. Now, the body tends to produce tremendous amounts of acid, and they need to be flushed. Now, when a person detoxes, very often they can feel worse before they feel better, because they have to detox their lymphatic system and the acid. And the acid is what goes into your muscles and makes them ache or makes them stiff. All right? So, yes, it is part of the detox, you might say, that comes through your body of the old you, the old stuff that no longer is part of you. It needs to be flushed out. So during this time, we would recommend drinking extra water. Perhaps we would recommend doing a little bit more of an alkaline-oriented diet. And very highly, we would recommend any kind of detoxing, such as colonics and things like that. That also can help the body flush it out. But the most important thing is the emotional, and which is what you have been doing. So we're very glad to see that. And on the mental level, there is, of course, beliefs that need to be shifted and beliefs that need to be changed. And there's also the redreaming that comes. You need to dream your new self. You need to dream from a place of an empowered spiritual light being. And as you dream this and you see and you claim this as your identity, as you step beyond that young adult and all her fantasies and all her dreams of what she had hoped she would achieve, all that happiness that she thought she was going to get in certain ways, as you step beyond that, the freedom of that, you see, you have to dream enough so that you can keep your box expanded. The problem with some people is that when the old stuff comes to be dumped, they go back into it. So we warn you, don't let yourself get trapped by that, okay?
Oh, yeah, I found that this morning when some stuff came up. And then at that moment, it's difficult for me to dream because I don't know where I'm heading. So I feel... is stuck the word? I guess that describes it.
Oh, all right. Well, that's a very good question in and of itself. The thing is that where are you heading? You see, now, most people tend to imagine a dream the way the young adult does, in form. Okay, I'm heading to this location where I'm going to fulfill this business, or I'm going to have this relationship and this family situation and blah, blah, blah. And they look that way as far as here's how I'm going to, you know, my lifestyle and where I'm going to live and how it's going to be and blah, blah, blah. So we suggest that's not where you're heading. That's just the form and structure of the manifestations that will come as the symptoms of where you're heading. Okay, where you're heading is claiming who you are as a powerful, beautiful, divine light being. That's where you're heading. And to being able to honor it and respect it and know it all through your day, even in a mundane life situation, no matter where you are, with who you're with, what you're doing, to be able to own your own identity as a divine and powerful light being, to be able to honor yourself and respect your own boundaries that nurture you, that support you, and also to look at your whole reality around you and see that as a manifestation of your images, to look at your reality around you and see that illusion as just being that, right? And that you can play with the illusion. You have a power to connect with it and move it as you will. Now, as you learn to do this where you're heading, you will find that more and more magic happens. You become more creative. You begin to have more visions, more dreams. Even your night dreams become more exciting and interesting. You see? That's where you're heading.
And so to start with this process, this is where we start doing the thing that you were suggesting before I phoned in, is in meditation, go and explore an environment. And mm-hmm. So is that how I start with this process of expansion and honoring the and manipulating the...
Well, yes, that's a way to kind of stretch your reality. But for you, in this particular case, if you want to be more focused on where you're heading, then what you may want to do is that you may want to go and, in this imagination, instead of going to a beautiful forest or some grand city on the astral plane or wherever you'd like to imagine yourself going, we suggest that you go into your future a couple of years and go hang out with your future self. And have her represent all the qualities you would like yourself to have. All the power, the freedom, the grace, the loving, the abundance, the joy, the celebration, the health, the absolutely everything that you could possibly want. Imagine, you know, go about 2 years in the future and imagine that this self has those. And that she's really honoring and understanding her own spiritual self and her divine nature. And so you go just hang out with her. Use your imagination. Make it up. Okay?
Okay.
And that will help you start the process, kind of jump start the process of dreaming and redreaming, rather. All right?
Okay.
Because you want to dream from a place of a divine being. You don't want to dream from the place of that, like that young adult who looks at life and says, life is all about things. You know that's not true, so you want to dream from the one who says, okay, life is about the glory of light and love and the expression of my divinity. Now, we've said before that there are three basic expressions of divinity that people have, and they're very high as far as motivators for people. It's the way that you get in contact, in connection with the divine within you. The first one is to love, touch, heal. We put those three together. You want to reach out. You want to connect. You want to love. You want to feel love. You want to give and receive love. You want to give and receive healing. You want to shift and change and love and grow with that, with someone else, and just give to others and be given to, and to have that kind of connection, that kind of union, that oneness. All right. The second one is creativity, to be passionate, to seek the pleasure of your own divine creation ability, to create, to imagine, to dream, to put something together, to manifest something. However your creativity shows itself, it is a quality of the divine. It's a quality in the essential nature of you. And the third one is to learn to discover, to grow, to expand, and to become more. And you are motivated by all three of these, you see. So what you want to do is when you go visit your future self, see the future self who is doing this love, touch, and healing, this passion and creativity, and this wonderful growing, learning, discovering, you see?
Right.
And in your life,
okay,
look at your own motivations in your daily life. Where are you love, touch, and healing? Where are you doing that? Where are you creating with passion? What is your passion? What do you feel really strongly within you that matters, that you can get so excited about? And if somebody disses it, you can get really angry in a hurry because you feel so passionate about it. And then, what about, you see, you're learning and growing. You have a tremendous desire to know. You, personally.
I love it.
You love it. Every time you learn something and make a shift and a change and expand it and see something from an exalted perspective, you go, wow, this is fantastic. I love this. You see? It's like a really great light hit, you know? So you like those. So go and play with those in your daily life and look at where you want to go with that. What would you like to do with that? How much of that can you do? How ecstatic will you be? You see, and go and sit with your future self and watch her and just kind of be with her and just enjoy to see the celebration that she is, you see.
Right. Right now I have created a very diverse life for me, and I get exhilarated about many different things.
Great.
And sometimes I feel like it's so many things I don't know where to focus. So I love doing the healings, I love creating, and I love learning new things. And then my fearful young adolescent says, well, how are you going to, where do you want to focus to earn enough money?
Right,
so
right.
The dollar bills comes in.
And then the perception here of the young adult is that you're going to have to shrink down to something. So, and focus there and make that work, you know, push and drive and make that work, and you have to focus on manifesting. Look at your beliefs around manifesting. You have a belief that in order to manifest money, there's all sorts of, almost a traumatic quality of doing that. It requires that you sacrifice. It requires that you work long hours, that you deny yourself some of the other pleasures and funds that you have to reduce your creativity, that you have to become dull and boring and focused, and that you have to put in all sorts of discipline when you want to play in all the divine levels and so forth and so on. So you look at what your beliefs are about that. This is a very common dynamic, very common issue. And for people who have discovered the wellspring of their own spirituality, because when you see enough of the illusion as it is, then in a sense you feel obligated in order to make money to bring yourself back into making the physical plane real again.
Right.
And that's a contraction.
That's the dilemma.
It's a contraction. If you can start to see the money issue as just as ephemeral, just as magical as some of your healing and creativity and so on, if you can start bringing the money creation to that level, you'll get all sorts of insights on how to do it without having to sweat and sacrifice and suffer.
Okay?
It should not be a dilemma that's an either or. Either I make a lot of money and I support myself decently and blah, 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 or I have the fun of being this, you know, creative, passionate, spiritual person. Now, we do want to point out that it's also possible to take the young adult image of the one who's like the independent, wealthy, retired one, who can do whatever they want, whenever they want, however they want it, with whomever they want to do it. And it is a fantasy that can get put onto your spiritual level. And if that's the case, then you like you would fall into the trap of being what we would call the spiritual dilettante. In other words, you just touch a little of this, ooh, that feels good, and touch a little of that, ooh, that feels good, oh, and do a little over here, oh, this feels really good, but never in any sense get into any depth with it. So the point here is that you want to create a reality in which you can do what you crave to do on a spiritual level, and to do it with depth, to really be able to learn how to focus, spiritually speaking, because that's going to bring you your money focus as effortlessly. You see what we're saying?
Okay.
You have to learn how to focus. That's one thing. Concentration is extremely important on all the inner planes, all the other dimensions. Your concentration, intention, focus is primary. It is absolutely pivotal. You don't see it as much on physical.
I have experienced that ability, and it's usually where it has to do with my children. When I've decided that I want something to happen on their behalf, for example, to send my boys away to camp, I was so focused and so single-minded about it that the money showed up in 3 days.
There you go.
So that sort of depth and focus.
Exactly.
Then
wonderful.
I asked myself, how do I do this on an everyday basis, this ability to focus and determine?
Well, you see, that focus came out of love and empowered responsibility. You love your children.
Thank
you. You know, you desire and yearn to love, touch, heal them. You want to create for them. You want to expand and grow your reality for them. There's a tremendous amount of love there, you see? And you took an empowered, responsible position as, I can do it. They're just children. It is my job to do it, and I choose to do that because I love them, all right? And I want them to have a fabulous life. Now, take that love, take that focus, and turn it on to yourself. Because sometimes in your past, you have, in a way, kind of discounted yourself.
Yes, it's true.
All right? So here's where the tire hits the road, spiritually speaking. If you will love yourself, if you will take care of yourself, if you will love and desire for you to have that incredible, glorious life, too, the focus will come through the ideas and creative ideas that you get, and things will just start to click, click, click. The magic will unfold. If you can sustain a large enough love for yourself, and if you can sustain a sense of future vision of you becoming more, if you can sustain a sense of illusion around money, you can do it.
Okay. Thank you very much for these very precise steps and instructions. They're very helpful for me.
You're certainly welcome, dear one. It was a pleasure to speak with you. All right.
Thanks again.
So farewell to you. All right. So that was a wonderful one. So we open up the phone lines again. Ah, here we have another caller. Yes, hello?
Hi, Alexis. It's Connie.
Well, hello. How are you, dear one?
I'm very well, thank you. You are getting into one of my favorite subjects that I like to call cosmic architecture.
Mm-hmm.
And I have so many questions about that. One of them is kind of basic. What is the difference between a plane and a dimension? I've read that, for example, fourth dimension comes really close to the astral plane. Well, can you talk about what the differences are?
Well, they have a correlation, but what we'd like to say is this. The fifth plane is outside the universe. So the fifth plane is beyond the seventh dimension.
Right.
Okay. Now, they kind of fall in there. Like, for example, when you go to fourth dimension, you move into astral plane.
Right.
Okay. Fifth, sixth, and seventh dimension, you will find yourself moving through astral and causal and supercausal planes. When you get into the eighth dimension, you get into a sense of oneness, of divine order, that kind of thing, and you'll find there it's beyond magic, it's beyond the miraculous, And in that place, you have become a master of your reality. And as you come to that place, you ascend and you sit upon the throne of self. That is a place where you and the greater you become one, and you're outside this universe.
And so is that where you're more at one with your soul, for example?
You're not necessarily, because you see, between you and your soul, you have your greater self or truer self. You have that kind of thing. And so what we would suggest is that you want to go there first.
Okay.
And your higher self is outside the universe. The higher self came into this universe and spread a whole bunch of lifetimes around.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So uh-huh. when you get into your higher self, you become one there. And it's as if you really see your own divinity. You feel that you and whoever, it is in the old traditions of India, for example, it is the becoming one with the guru.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And generally, it does not happen in physical plane experience. Generally, it happens after death in their, mythology. But it doesn't have to happen that way any longer. There's been a new dispensation that took place back in the 1960s.
Mm.
Okay? So in this new dispensation, you're able to become fully realized and step into the ownership of your divine self to connect with and become one with your greater self or your truer self, maybe not necessarily really there to your higher self, while you're still in physical body.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, imagination and creativity and chaos and magic and miracles will take you through the astral causal and supercausal, depending on where your focus is.
Supercausal is otherwise known as mental plane?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right. And there is where you'll find freedom from limiting beliefs. Now, we want you to understand, ego goes all the way through there.
Oh.
All right?
Right.
Ego goes all the way up until finally you leave the universe and you go to fifth plane. All right? And when you go there, then you step beyond ego. And you can actually experience, in brief moments of extremely high and powerful and profound meditations, moments without, ego at all, because you are not really, your focus is not in your physical body.
Mm-hmm.
But when you come back, you will still have to take on an ego. That's part of being physical. But if you're fully self-realized, you will not have any negativity in that ego. It will function flawlessly for you.
Right. As the messenger it was meant to be.
Yes, as it was originally conceived, so that your creations are, pretty much instant, whatever it is that you desire. Now, you don't have to get all there in your physical lifetime, but if you have a hook there, if you have a connection there, to the higher self, to the greater you, you can decide not to come back.
Mm-hmm.
At the time of your death, you can see, okay, this is it.
Mm-hmm.
I could go back and do a little bit of this, and I could do a little of that, and I could explore that, but I don't think I want to.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll live on the inner planes, and you'll work your way up to fifth plane, and you'll work your way up out of the realms of matter, which go all the way through the universe, through the planes, through the fourth plane, is all the matter. And where spirit is more and matter is less, until finally you pop out, and as you pop out of the material universe, this particular universe, you will fly through a sky filled with universes.
Okay.
Right now, you fly through a starry sky when you go into the astral plane.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can imagine flying through a sky filled with universes that look like glowing eggs.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So I'm trying to understand the differences in how a corporeal and a non-corporeal being can experience these different planes or dimensions. For example, the beings that comprise Galexis. Mm-hmm. You're apparently non-corporeal. That's my guess, right?
Well, that's true. That's true. Well, actually, some of us are actually other lifetimes of beings who actually are physical right now.
Uh-huh. So there's some overlap there.
Yeah, we like to get a wide range of perspective,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. We all appreciate so much.
You're very welcome. And so we also are comprised of beings from other universes to give us uh-huh. that exalted perspective from beyond the universe. So it helps us in that mm-hmm. regard to get a kind of a idea of where you can have a track, a growth track, a spiritual track to move on.
Uh-huh.
And our objective, our main part of our mission, you might say, is to assist people while they are in physical body, in physical form, to be able to apply their spiritual power, their spiritual awareness, their spiritual awakening to their mundane life.
Mm-hmm.
That's just our focus.
Yeah, it's very helpful. Oh, my gosh, we all really appreciate what you give to us.
Thank you, dear one. Thank you.
Yeah. So there's part of what I'd like to understand is how, for example, the shiny ones operate. Are they in a particular dimension? Are they operate in a particular plane? They don't have any what is left of what we consider to be form other than just pure light. Are they considered corporeal?
Well,
it gets tricky in
well, there. You see, the thing is, you're probably referring to the shining ones of Sirius, are
yes.
you not?
Yes.
All right, because you see, there are shining ones in other places.
You've told me that, yes.
All right. Well, the shining ones of Sirius, specifically, we would say that some of them are still corporeal, some of them are not.
Hmm. Okay.
All right.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Now, the reason that some of them still are is because they like to they like to function as teachers.
Mm-hmm.
If they were strictly, you know, non-physical, they would may not be as helpful as, you know, they could be
mm-hmm.
For some people. Some mm-hmm. people don't do too well with all the teachings coming from non-physical states.
Mm-hmm.
And we recognize that. It's part of the mythology, the resistance, the appreciation of, the dislike of, and all those kinds of really strong reactions to channeling that go on the planet today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also because a lot of people who channel bring in information that has no useful applied value.
Yes.
And so it just sounds like, okay, these people are just out to lunch, you know, mm-hmm. going for this. So we can understand that, but you see, the shining ones recognize that some people will find that more useful, and some people will find that less useful. And one of the things that they like to do, the shining ones, is
okay.
that they like to connect. They like to express their divinity, too. They like to love, touch, and heal. They mm-hmm. like to create. They have passion, too. They like to expand and grow and learn and discover, too. You see?
Mm-hmm.
And most people would look at them and say, wow, they're already there, as mm-hmm. if there is an end somewhere. And, of course, we want to remind you that they're continuously expanding and going out on different planes and different dimensions and just, you know, running around. And then they come back and they radiate their light to mm-hmm. those who they love, and they touch those who they love.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are quite a number of us here now, incarnated now on this planet, who had made the choice to have some other lifetime be their last lifetime. In other words, this is an elective lifetime. And what kind of state did we and they reside in?
You mean you and the other lifetime that is going to be the final lifetime?
No, other people who are here. There's a number of us who are here as an elective lifetime. We didn't really need to come back. We chose to.
Well, we want to point out that every one of you chooses at the time of death. You basically choose whether you want to come back or not. It's always mm-hmm. a choice.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Right, and so some of you chose to come back because you wanted to be here at this particular time on the planet.
Exactly.
Hence the world, the planet is filled and overflowing with population right now.
Right.
So many have come to witness the change and participate in it as well.
Right.
So it is always a choice. So basically, what are you asking? Are you asking about what about people who are not going to get self-realized in this lifetime?
No, I was asking more about, you had talked to me in particular that this is an elective lifetime for myself. I didn't really need to come back, that I'd already had what I had considered at the time my last lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a number of us like that here,
yes.
And we did choose to come back specifically to participate in this tremendous opportunity now. So I was wondering what kind of state, well, particularly with me, what kind of state was I in? Where was I residing when I made that kind of decision to come back and pursue a lifetime when I hadn't really wanted to before? Was it a dimension? Was it a plane? Was I already outside of the universe? Or
no, you weren't. You weren't. It's been tooted about, in all sorts of martyr nobility, the bodhisattva vow, where those who are just about to become enlightened say, no, I don't think so. I'm going to come back and I'm going to help humanity, and I'm not going to step into absolutely enlightenment and absolute spiritual divinity and the light until everybody gets there.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it's been mentioned as, these are the world teachers, blah, blah, blah. But what we would like to say is that very often, once you get to a place to where you don't need to have a lifetime anymore,
mm-hmm.
all of a sudden, lifetimes don't look like a lack of fun anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They don't hold within themselves, lessons and hardships and stuff like that. In a sense, all of a sudden, it's like, wow, I can do this. And in that lifetime, I can play with this and I can do that. And it becomes an excitement.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes a pleasure that you can do that and really be present and do the shift of consciousness within yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And to apply it on the physical plane. Essentially, the reason that you came back, even though you didn't need to, was so that you could apply.
Mm-hmm.
So you could be awakened in a physical body.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
All right?
Yeah.
But you still have the majority of you, you want to understand, is on an inner plane meditating right now.
Yes. I connect to that. Every so often I do. And it's just an incredible sensation.
Right. Yeah, but it's just in this incredible higher plane, like she's in this greater being of you, is probably in, causal plane or mental plane,
uh-huh.
just meditating away and having a fantastic time.
Yeah.
Whereas, and then when you die, then all the lifetimes, when you die, you're saying, okay, this is the one, I'm not going to do anymore. I don't need to do anymore. I got what I wanted with this great shift. I participated the way I wanted to. This is really great. I'm really ready to go for it now. This is it. Then all your lifetimes pull together, and you just shoot up into the higher dimension and into that self that's there, and it's almost like a force, a power, a light that just like a rocket, and you just go boom right on out to fifth plane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sounds lovely. I mean, the first time Lazarus even mentioned that possibility, my hand was in the air. Sign me up. That's what I want. I had no hesitation.
Well, right. Now, one of the things we do want to point out is that before you die, you will get to a place to where you will not hold any charge that is remaining on being physical.
Yeah,
because part of you lifting your hand and saying, yes, I want that, was a part of you that part of you didn't really like physical playing too much. All right?
Yes.
And that's
going
to end. You're going to be absolutely clear that the physical plane was a wonderful, fun playground. You had a fabulous time. That's really great. And
yeah, I've got a way to go with that one.
All right. No charge whatsoever. No, and all those memories of difficult times, gone, done.
Right.
All right, dear one, a pleasure to speak with you.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Thank
all
you.
Right.
I love
so
you.
Farewell
bye-bye.
To you. Thank you. And we thank also the other that has asked us questions and so on. And we thank all of you who have listened in for being with us on this program today. We are so delighted we got a chance to speak about some really fun topics. And so we invite you to come to our website, listen to some of the workshops where we delve into them in great depth and explore all sorts of new states of consciousness with you. Because we can work with you directly, privately, personally, through our workshops. Every single one of them, we have a connection with you when you play it. So it is to our great pleasure if you will do some of this wonderful exploration. And if you live in the LA area, please come and see us in person. Perhaps it's not in person, but in channel. All right, so we wish you the well, and we will be with you again in another couple of weeks, perhaps. So be it, and we wish all of you to walk and enjoy your path of power. So farewell for now.
Changing World, Conscious Co-Creation Productions presents A Voice of Truth and Inspiration, resonating a vibration of love and understanding, illuminating new paths for new directions, as we, as one, strive for higher and higher planes of existence, always remembering life changes. This is radio like you've never felt before. Life Changes with Filippo. And now, your host, our MC, the Master of Change, Filippo Voltaggio.
I like that. Thank you, Dorothy. No wonder you wanted to do the intro today. MC Master of Change, that's clever. Okay. Well, you know, speaking of clever, you know, I don't want to talk too long because we have David Weddle on the show with us today, and this has been such an anticipated show. So many people have been writing in, and what are you going to ask him, and what are you going to say, and ask him to write this for this character on CSI. And for those of you who don't know, he's a writer and a producer for CSI, Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Of course, he's not writing for that anymore, and Battlestar Galactica, he's not writing for that anymore either. But anyways, so it's been really exciting around here because David Weddle is going to be on this show. But talking about clever things that people say and people write, I just got an email from a friend of mine who's actually a singer, and you might all know him. It's Alfio, and he's Australian, and he sings all over the world, doing quite well, actually. And he wrote, "Change is sometimes as good as a holiday, but sometimes as unwelcome as a fly in your minestra," which is like a soup. "Dealing with change is the key." So that came to us from Alfio today in the mail, and I just thought I have to share that. But, of course, we're going to be talking to David today about writing and where stories come from and ideas, especially when it's outside of our normal realm of possibilities that us normal people see. And speaking of normal people, actually, last week, as you remember, we had Johnny Seitz on the show. And here's something I forgot to mention. You know, Johnny is considered autistic, as you know, because we talked about it the whole show. But one of the first things he did, besides analyze me, which you all know because we talked about that, one of the first things that he did that we didn't talk about was he started to scribble with both hands at the same time on a piece of paper. And I looked at him, and he says, "Can you do that?" And I thought, "Yeah." And then he says, "Now hold this up to a mirror." And I did, and he had written a whole sentence twice, backwards, with both hands at the same time. I can't even write backwards with one hand, much less two. I thought that was absolutely amazing, and this was something he just grew up with and was able to do. So it's interesting, you know, what people can tap into, and that's one of the things that I can't wait to talk to David about. But during that interview last week with Johnny, he was trying to give an example, and I brought up the analogy of my voice teacher, one of them who couldn't teach me how to sing, but she was a famous singer. The other one who wasn't a famous singer, but was able to teach me how to sing. And the reason was because the first one, she was born with a natural talent to sing and didn't know how to get that sound. It just happened. The second one, my voice coach, and his name was Irv Winward. He taught a lot of the Hollywood celebrities in his day, Natalie Wood and all kinds of people you all would recognize. And he didn't have a naturally beautiful voice. He didn't open up his mouth and a beautiful voice came out. But he wanted to sing so badly, he learned how. And so he was able to teach me how to get my naturally beautiful voice to come out. And so I was fascinated by the analogy that we used, rather, for the show, was that the same with David, or Johnny, rather. Johnny had to learn how to be normal. So he was able to teach, now he's able to teach normal people how to be more normal, which is kind of a weird thing. So my voice coach, Irv Winward, I would be fascinated by the things he would tell me with a man. He was 85 years old when I stopped coaching with him. And the things he would tell me, just, he was in the war, he was a captain, all of these things. But the most interesting things were these things that you couldn't really put your finger on it. You'd say, well, okay, I understand the war analogies, and I understand, you know, you did this and you did that. But this stuff about aliens and spaceships, did you see them? Were they there? And he'd say, no, but I didn't see them, but I knew they were there. Or I knew they helped me in this situation, which was the most bizarre thing to me, because I wanted the proof. I wanted the scientific proof. And so one day, out of the blue, his wife, Shirley, who would hear me arguing with him, we're supposed to be having a voice lesson, and we're arguing about, are there spaceships out there and ETs and all that, and she came to me and she said, I want to give you something. And she gave me a love letter that she had written to her husband, Irv, many years ago, because evidently, every night, Irv builds a spaceship. Now, he wouldn't tell me or couldn't tell me whether he thinks he actually does this or whether he's just fantasizing and this is how he lulls himself to sleep or how he spends his time when he can't sleep. He would just smile when I would ask him the question, which makes me believe that he believed that he would somehow be beamed up every night and would build a spaceship. And his wife would hear about it every morning or... and she finally wrote this letter. So I have to read it to you. I asked her permission. This is Shirley Winward, and it's called Love Letter. My beloved builds a spaceship every night, courting sleep by expanding its massive girth mile by mile, adding level after level. The structure spins immensely in its orbit, opposite the Earth. It cannot be seen, and it is here, he goes, each dream time, in full command of his creation. On occasion, he brings me up to date on his celestial agenda. His eyes gleam amber, his glasses fall off his nose, his facial wrinkles deepen to fine earnestness. He permits me to take in how huge this enclosed labyrinthian has become. By now, he has forested 12 million acres on one level, filled lakes as deep as Tahoe on another, fetched cloud systems in cycles as natural as our own breathing, set animal genetics in motions on our gargantuan veldt, fashioned self-restoring engines bigger than New York City. On his latest junket, I dare to ask, where are the people? And he says, not answering exactly, this ship will weather 10,000 3 trillion years across the universes through the great buildup of forces that lead to the next Big Bang. And caressing my hand, you and I, at each grand galactic shift, always you and I will be there. We'll come around together. We'll come around again. Shirley Winward to her beloved Irv Winward. And so I wonder, where does this come from? It seems to me beyond imagination. And so I thought that would be the perfect lead-in. I've had this letter for years now, and yet I've never thought about it until now. I thought it would be the perfect lead-in for our next guest, who writes beyond what I feel is our imagination. So I can't wait to talk to a Nebula Award-nominated screenwriter, David Weddle, who is currently a writer and co-executive producer on CSI, as you all know. He served as a writer-producer for all 4 seasons of Battlestar Galactica and has written for such shows as Star Trek, Deep Space Nine, The Twilight Zone, and Kate Shackoff's first series, The Fearing Mind. David is also author of 2 books, the critically acclaimed If They Move, Kill 'Em, The Life and Times of Sam Peckinpah, and the bestseller, Among the Mansions of Eden. He has written for such publications as Rolling Stone, the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, the San Francisco Chronicle, Sight and Sound, Film Comment, Variety, San Jose Mercury, the list goes on and on. And just recently, Battlestar Galactica was just named Program of the Year by the Television Critics Association. Actually, that was just a couple weeks ago. So with that, we'd like to welcome on the show David Weddle.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Hi, David. It's great to have you, and thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Did you hear that poem?
I did.
Can you relate in any way to that?
I can... I think that science fiction, science fantasy, and people's imaginations being ignited by all that is runs very deep, and I think that it relates to the mythologies and myths and religious stories that we've been telling to each other around campfires since we first stood upright, probably on the savanna of Africa. So I relate to it in that way. I think these are powerful stories, and they're mythic stories, and they don't just talk. They're not just about beings in the outer space. They're really about us, I think. They're really about our struggles to understand who we are, why we're here, what's the meaning of it all, how do we cope with sort of hideous truths about existence that are very hard to cope with. I guess what I'm telling you is I look at that from a Joseph Campbell perspective or a Carl Jung's perspective.
Like the archetypes of these characters that we are living in another way.
Mm-hmm. And I think that they relate to our humanity and aspects of our humanity and our struggle to understand ourselves.
Wow, so sometimes maybe we put these situations into somebody else, something that is outside of us, so we can relook at it.
That's right. To mythic archetypes, yes, absolutely.
Wow, interesting. Well, you certainly make us look at a lot of things with what you write. But let's start since you've gone there. You're a big fan of Westerns.
Yes, I am.
And
because Westerns are also an archetypal form of storytelling, and the Western takes place across vast expanses of land far away from civilization or and the infrastructure of civilization, where people are usually on epic journeys, physical epic journeys across vast spaces, but that it often becomes a journey, an inner journey as well, because there's no law enforcement apparatus or court system or edifice of government to tell them what's right and what's wrong. There's no church to tell them what they should or shouldn't believe and what's moral and not moral. And the characters in Westerns are forced to make existential choices about who they are, what they stand for, what their life means, what actions they're going to take to give their life meaning. And really the same is true in the science fiction genre. The two genres have a lot in common, and they have a lot in common with ancient mythic stories of the myths of ancient Greece or Egypt, or they have a lot in common with the Iliad and the Odyssey. Sam Peckinpah said who I wrote a book about, who was the last great American Western filmmaker, has a great quote by him where he said, "The facts of the Trojan War don't interest me that much. What Homer makes of it all, though, I find fascinating." So, it's that spinning of a myth, archetypal myth, that is an interpretation of events that Peckinpah found interesting, and that's what you can do in science fiction, and you can also do it in Westerns, or in, stories of ancient civilizations, or fantasy tales.
You know, it's interesting that you should say that about Sam Peckinpah and focus in on that, because I actually was going to focus in on yet another one of your favorite people, Ken Kesey, and the book Sometimes a Great Nation, right? Or Notion.
Notion.
And he wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and one thing that I was reading about that was the quote, "Narrative voice and perspective shifts frequency between time periods and between characters, creating the thematically relevant sense that there is no core truth, only interpretations of events."
Mm-hmm.
So
sometimes a great notion does that brilliantly. And actually, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is an archetypal tale, both in the movie and especially in the book. McMurphy is in a sense a cowboy hero who strides onto that ward, and the big nurse could be seen as the equivalent of the guy who owns half the town and is being unjust and so on and so forth. It fits very much. Kesey draws on archetypes from Westerns and American Frontier stories and injects them all into this mental ward on a hospital. I think a lot of people mistakenly try to interpret that novel as a critique of American mental health systems and a critique of Freud and psychology, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think it's any of those things. I think he's using that microcosm to create a mythic story about the human condition
and tell a story about that.
Right. It's kind of timeless.
Well, you know, there's so many ways we could go with this. There's so many things that you just said a whole... What you just said, we could talk for hours on, obviously. You know, if we talk about Campbell's work and how it relates here, we could talk about each of the characters that you put in any of these, or that you develop in any of your shows and just break it down. It could take forever, and I'm sure people would love that. But to keep it a little general here, here are these characters that in the Western did things a certain way, and then... Is it true when you saw Sam Peckinpah's work? What was that movie?
The Wild Bunch, right?
That you said, "Oh, wait a minute, that's never been done in a Western." And so, what was that, and how did that affect you?
Well, it's not unlike what Ron Moore has done with Battlestar Galactica. You know, any of us who've watched. Most of the people listening to this have probably watched hundreds of science fiction movies.
Uh-huh.
Maybe not as many people watch Westerns anymore, but when I was growing up, everyone had seen hundreds of Westerns. And what happens is you become familiar with the archetypes, the types of characters, the gambler, the con man, the gunslinger, the sheriff, the farmer who's just trying to raise a crop, the borderland bad banditos and so on and so forth. And then you go into a saloon and certain kinds of scenes happen in a saloon. There's the dance hall girl. There's a face-off that starts. There's the shootout in the street. All of these things become part of they become archetypal codes that once we've seen a lot of these movies and read a lot of these stories, we all recognize them. Here's the saloon scene. You know, so what Peckinpah did and what Ron Moore did in Battlestar Galactica was to take all those sort of tropes, those familiar set pieces, and rip them apart or turn them inside out, and what you think is going to happen doesn't happen. But then once you've done that and you sort of break apart the cliches, you know, they sort of reach down into the wreckage of that and find the truth beneath the cliches and reclaim the genre. And I give you an example from The Wild Bunch. When I was 13 watching with my dad, that affected me very much, is there's a character called Angels from a Mexican village, and he's
right.
trying to convince his band of outlaws that he rides with to get guns for his people because his people are being unjustly oppressed by the federales and the corrupt Mexican authorities. So they finally do this for him. They steal some guns for him that are supposed to go to a warlord, a Mexican general. In one point in the drama, there's a train robbery, and Ernest Borgnine almost falls through the cars, and Angel rescues him. He grabs him and pulls him out from between the train cars, and there's a shot where Ernest Borgnine wants to thank him, but that's not a macho thing to do and doesn't say anything. Well, later, toward the end of the drama, the Mexican warlord finds out that Angel stole some rifles and gave them to people that the warlord, you know, doesn't want them to have weapons. And he confronts Angel and Ernest Borgnine when they're inside his fortress. It's just the two of them. They're delivering some rifles that they were contracted to steal for this general. And the general says, "What happened to the case of rifles?" And Borgnine says, "Oh, we lost them." And then the general looks right at Angel and says, "He stole them."
And so what do you want us to do with him? And Borgnine looks at Angel and then looks at the general and says, he's a thief. You deal with him. And he rides out of the fort. Now, I, as a kid at 13, like, no hero in a movie does that.
Right.
Rides out on the guy who saved his life and makes no effort to save him and to save his own skin, lies, and runs for it. And so it deconstructs the whole mythology. But what Peckinpah does very intricately is he starts laying on the back of these characters, Ernest Borgnine and William Holden, their failures. They have a code that Holden enunciates, which is not unlike a code you've heard in many Western movies. When you side with a man, you stick with him. If you can't do that, you're some kind of animal. Well, Holden breaks his own code all through the movie. Whenever it's expedient and survive, comes down to saving his own skin, he'll leave anybody behind. He'll betray his best friends. But gradually through the movie, he's forced to face that he's done this over and over and over again. And it comes down to Angel, who's being tortured by Mapache. And the first Holden and then Ernest Borgnine, they can't live with running out on this man. And they go back finally in the end of the movie to reclaim him. And even though it means certain death for all of them. And Peckinpah so meticulously builds it up and so infuses it with the spirit of the times, which was the height of the Vietnam War, that by the end of the movie when they do this and they go out in an apocalyptic battle, suddenly the genre is alive and the core romanticism of the Western genre is reclaimed and and it all feels fresh and alive and vital because Peckinpah's faced the lies behind it as well. And Ron Moore did that in Battlestar Galactica, very much so. With the same, I think, depth and complexity of vision, too.
Very clever, and it adds a whole other dimension to it. And speaking of dimensions, okay, so you said at one point it's no accident that Roddenberry called space the final frontier. Mm-hmm. Now, I thought that was interesting that you would say that, obviously, because there's the great frontier that the Westerns were all about, right? And now we're into the universe and that being a frontier, but it being the final frontier, in your opinion, does that mean this is the last step for our evolution that we have to, you know, conquer this frontier or,
Well, I wouldn't, it was no accident that Roddenberry made that comparison. I don't know if I would focus so heavily on final in that, but you take a look at all of human history and then particularly American history and, you know, for most of our whole existence, it's been standing up in the tall grass of the savannah of Africa and going, okay, well, is this all there is? I wonder what's on the other side of that hill. I wonder what's beyond that river. I wonder what, if we could get across that body of water, I wonder what's over there. I bet it's fantastic over there, or I bet there's monsters over there, or I don't know. And so human beings have been driven, it's part of our very DNA, and to go out and see what's on the other side of the mountain. And I remember Ken Kesey talking about this with me. And so then, well, finally, it came to the Vikings, and maybe people before the Vikings, and then the Spanish saying, well, I don't know if the world just drops off on the other side of this water. Well, what if there's something on the other side? Let's go find out. And then the history of America, as soon as we landed on the East Coast, or the South, or, you know, in some cases the West Coast, the very next impulse, but let's just stick with the East Coast for the moment, was to move west. I wonder what's through that forest. I wonder what's on the other side of that river. I wonder if there's a Northwest Passage. I bet there's something even better across that valley. And
right.
They kept going until they got to the other side, and then there was nowhere else to go. They're standing and they're looking at this is actually a very big theme written in Sometimes a Great Notion, and they're standing looking at the Pacific Ocean, and what now? We ran out of places to go. And so then we started looking up. So, I mean, I think it's an inherent drive in human beings and space. There's nothing left to discover practically. I mean, maybe in a few deep trenches of the ocean we can find, you know, a few mollusks that we've never seen before or whatever. But basically we have explored every nook and cranny of this planet And yet that hunger to discover, to face the unknown, to explore, I mean, is there. And so space offers the opportunity for that, and then it offers all the opportunities for stories about islands with cyclopses on them, giant squid, sea serpents, islands with a maze with a monster in it, which become planets and asteroids,
right.
And, you know, and magical creatures that we will discover as we go out there. I mean, all that is all of that appeal to our subconscious is, you know, is there in the idea of space exploration and then tales of outer space. And when we tell tales of outer space now, it's all still possible because we haven't really gotten beyond our own moon. So it's all possible again.
The way it
might have been possible for the Vikings when they were staring out across the water, you know.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you were thinking along the same lines as I was with this whole process of each step from being in the grass to now here we are, civilization, looking beyond us. However, I don't know if I was taking a more cynical approach, but I was thinking as far as, again, back to like Westerns and the archetypes of, you know, the good guys and the bad guys. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe when we were in the grass, the bad guys might have been the animals, and we had to, like, fight off the lions or what have you. And then it was another tribe. And so then, you know, when you said the Europeans came to America, the bad guys were the Indians in their opinion. And that was what the Westerns were all about. Well, now we've created, you know, and then there were the Russians, like, you know, the Rocky thing, the Russians. Well, what's the next thing that Rocky could fight? I mean, an alien, you know, so now we're into the universe. But after we don't want to be fighting Indians anymore, and we don't want to be fighting animals, and we don't want to be fighting Russians. So now we're fighting the aliens. Now, when it's discovered that either aliens are friendly or they don't exist or whatever it is that, you know, ends up happening or they're part of us or what have you, then what is there? And that's where I was getting at the final frontier.
Hmm.
You know, what is there? What would you write then?
I'm not quite clear on your question.
Okay, so when we're done fighting aliens, who can we fight after the aliens?
Well, each other. We've been fighting each other ever since we could pick up a rock.
Well, exactly. But, you know,
we don't need aliens to kill and have aggression. And there's this endless supply of each other to do that with.
Interesting.
So, the tales of battles in space are really a reflection of our own love of slaughter, which, in truth, we do. We love to talk. We love it. Our presidents love to talk about how we're a peace-loving nation, and Americans love nothing more than prosperity, and peace, and democracy. And we all nod our heads, and we all say, oh, yeah, that's me. Yeah, we love peace, except we've had war, like, almost since the beginning of this country. We've had very few years of peace, and we're hardly unique about that in that sense. I mean, all of the Middle East is a festival of killing people that are killing your relatives. And killing people who have a belief system that's almost exactly like yours, except it differs in syntax or a few nouns here and there. But there's nobody you like to kill more than the people that have a belief system that's competitive with yours. So I think that fantasies of war and conflict are a reflection of who we are, too.
So if it became unfashionable or to fight aliens, then we'd be back to...
I don't think it's going to, well, I don't think in terms of tales of outer space, it's going to become unfashionable.
Okay. Well,
to think so. It would be lovely to think at some point it would become unfashionable, but I don't really see that as happening. I mean, I see no sign of it, of that on the horizon.
Okay, well, and before I forget here, before we move from the Cowboys and the Aliens thing, I thought it was interesting that there's a movie coming out, Cowboys and Aliens, that Ron Howard is doing, and I thought, who would have been perfect to write about that but you? So
I didn't know that was happening, but that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the working title, Cowboys and Aliens. And I thought, wow, how perfect. This has got David Weddle written all over it.
Well, there they are. They're going right for the mixture of the two archetypal story forms. Yeah.
Exactly.
It may be in a very kitsch and funny, you know, slapstick level, but it still will be the interfacing of those mythologies.
Right. Well, I don't know. It's Ron Howard, so it'll remain to be seen. And by the way, I have to give a shout out to you by two friends of yours and two friends of mine, Kate Vernon, of course, who played Ellen Tai in Battlestar Galactica. She wanted to be here, thinking that you were going to be here as well, and you thought you were going to be here as well. But obviously, CSI is making you work overtime.
I very much wanted to be there, and I'm very sorry that I couldn't. My hours are. The television business is insane. That's lovely that she was going to come. I just saw her the other day. She's a wonderful, talented actress, a beautiful woman, and both outwardly and inwardly.
We love her too. And Patricia Murray was going to be here, and fans would know her as the makeup artist, the Emmy-nominated makeup artist.
Oh, really? She's in town?
She's in San Diego, but she was going to drive up. But we.
Oh, that's right. She does go to San Diego fairly regularly. That's right.
Yeah, from Vancouver. So,
Patricia worked with me not only on Battlestar Galactica, but on Katie Sackhoff, who played Starbuck, her first series of Fearing Mind, and Patricia was on that show, too.
Oh, I didn't know that.
At Vancouver Film Studios, yes.
Well, that's great. So it would have been like old home week here had that happened. Well, you know what? We'll just have to make it happen another time for another reason. But
okay.
So here we are. I think this is one of the funniest things that you said, that you just fell into writing sci-fi when you are arguably the most prolific and well-known sci-fi writer of our time. So how does this just happen?
No, okay, that's a little overblown, but I appreciate it, but I'm not one of them.
Oh, okay.
I'm a successful science fiction writer. I've made a lot of my career in television has been that, and I was lucky to work on one of the greatest science fiction television shows of all time. I will admit that, but I was only one of many, and much of the credit deserves to go to Ron Moore and David Icke. So.
Very well, and we give them credit absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
But how does it just happen? Oh,
well,
and your writing partner too. Should we mention?
Bradley Thompson, yes.
Right, absolutely.
well, it was a literal connection between Westerns and science fiction. I mean, I had an interest in science fiction as a kid, like any normal kid. I was not a science fiction fanatic like many people that I've worked with on shows. Many writers just devoured every science fiction novel and movie, and I was not that person. I did love Planet of the Apes, both the novel by Pierre Boulle and the movie 2001, of course, I loved. I read all the Jules Verne, H.G. Wells books. Kurt Vonnegut, I read a lot of. But I wouldn't call myself as an encyclopedic expert on science fiction, but I did know Westerns inside and out, and I wrote a biography on Sam Peckinpah, and Ira Stephen Bear, who was the executive producer of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, loved my book on Peckinpah, and he invited me to Paramount Studios for lunch to talk about my book, and then he walked me through all the sound stages where they were shooting Deep Space Nine, and being a shameless opportunist, I said, could I try pitching stories to your show? He said, sure. He sent me a whole stack of materials. I'd never watched Star Trek Deep Space Nine. I asked Bradley, who I'd gone to USC with, who I knew was a science fiction fan, much more so than me. He's a very intense science fiction fan, and he knew the Star Trek genre, though he didn't really know Deep Space Nine. We sat down to watch it, and I didn't know what the hell anybody was talking about. I didn't know what a Ferengi was or a Cardassian. I said, what the hell's going on here? And we had to study it for a couple of months. And then we went in and pitched a story, and we sold a story, and then we sold a couple scripts, and they put us on staff, and then suddenly in the eyes of Hollywood, I'm a science fiction writer. But my familiarity with the Western genre has stood me well throughout my career, because I many times bring up Westerns, classic Westerns, because the storytelling, the kinds of stories they tell, are very analogous to science fiction tales.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, somebody said about you that there's a...
You can use them as an outline or template to proceed from.
Right. Was it you or somebody said there's a Sam Peckinpah line in every episode that you write?
Every episode of Battlestar Galactica, almost every one. There might be one or two that we missed, but for the most part, there are Sam Peckinpah references in almost all of them.
Okay, so
a game among the staff to spot them, and then some of the other writers started doing their own.
So basically, you're just writing Westerns and they're putting them in alien costumes. Is that it?
No, I wouldn't go that far.
I'm playing.
Yeah.
Okay, so would you give us a little insight on how does this creative process happen? So what do you do? You're going to write an episode now. At least we're talking about the space stuff, or actually it doesn't matter, any of this. What is David Weddle's creative process look like, look and feel like?
Usually the executive producer is your guiding light. In the case of Battlestar Galactica, was Ron Moore. At CSI, it's Carol Mendelson and Naren Shankar. Sometimes the writer has an idea, the individual writer. Sometimes the showrunner, they call them the showrunner, the executive producers who run the writing room, will have an idea. The staff sits in a room together, and there may be anywhere from 5 to 10 people. And you have a giant either whiteboard with the grease pencils, or you have big cork boards with index cards. And you begin to bat around the ideas of how this story you want to tell could unfold. And there is always somebody in the room who is designated as running the room. It could be often one of the executive producers, but sometimes it's a co-executive producer. On Battlestar Galactica was Mark Verheiden, who ran the room when Ron Moore was not there. That person has to make the decisions, as the different egotistical writers are loudly arguing their variant. I think it should be this way. No, I think it should be that way. I think my idea is better. That person says, okay, I like Bob's idea. Let's do that. Let's open the show this way. And ideally, when it's really working well, it's like a jazz band, as it did on Battlestar. People feed off ideas, and the ideas start to explode, and the cards go up on the board, and it all suddenly starts falling together. You're not even quite sure how it's happening. But that's often preceded by a couple of days of tremendous struggle that's like wading through a waist-deep swamp of stinking mud before you finally break out on the solid ground.
You make it sound so glamorous, David.
Yeah, it's not. And then for me, it's always important to know who is my protagonist. That's who's the story about. What is the emotional journey that character's going on in this episode? When I understand that, everything comes into focus better for me. If I don't know that, I'm lost and flailing, and it will not be a good episode.
Well, actually, it's interesting that you should end like that. I was going to ask you, and for yourself, do you have a message that seems to travel through all your work, or that you would like to bring out, or just happens to come out?
Well, I'll leave you with something that Ken Kesey said. I have a big poster on my wall, and it informs all my writing, and it's a good quote for approach to life too, and spiritual issues and the mysteries of existence and so on. Ken Kesey said, don't look for the answer. The answer, I've seen people think they found the answer and then they stop thinking. Look for the mystery. The job is to seek out the mystery, to plant a garden where strange things blossom. The mystery is much more interesting than the answer. I'm sort of butchering that quote, but that's the basic thought.
Yeah, I got the meaning behind it, and that's interesting because you've certainly given us a lot of mystery to ponder. And during this interview, I was thinking about the poem that I started off with at the beginning, and how it could be people like you that have influenced people like my old voice coach to create and fantasize, or maybe that is happening, maybe it's not happening, maybe it's through what you have done and people like you, but in a sense, you are changing the world by doing what you do. You are changing the way we look at the universe, and you are changing the way we look at ourselves by looking outside ourselves. And how does that feel for you? How does it ring?
It feels good.
I see
we have concerts at Bear McCreary, our composer for Battlestar, and people come from all over, and these musical themes relating to various episodes and characters. You see the people grouped around and actually swaying and being, and you can see that they're thinking about a parent that they lost, or a romance that ended and left them shattered, or one of the great, most exalted moments of their life. And you realize that this show is just like a fire that people can gather around and stare into and tell their stories and relate to, and a tribe is formed around that show that we created, and that feels very good.
Wow, David,
I'm proud to have been able to do that, play a part in creating something like that.
Well, you're still young, and you've got many years of doing this, should you choose to. I know that Hollywood is clamoring to be working with you, and we're happy about that. We've been talking to David Weddle, who at the moment is a writer and co-executive producer on CSI. And we didn't talk much about CSI because we've been talking about how he's changing the way we look at the universe and how he's come to that. But he's also author of the book, If They Move, Kill 'Em. That's a great title. The Life and Times of Sam Peckinpah. So you are fascinating. We could talk to you for hours, but that's as much time as we have at this point. We'd love to have you back at some point with all of our other friends that you know as well, and maybe at a live event. But in the meantime, we've been honored by having you on our show, David.
Thank you, Philippe. I really appreciate the interest.
Okay. We'll talk to you soon, I hope.
Okay. Great.
All right. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Wow. I mean, what can you say? And like I said, we could talk hours about so many of the topics that came up with David, and hopefully one of these days we will. Well, David is certainly a luminary in our times as he writes about things that help us look at ourselves and look at the universe, and is changing the way we do that. And now we have one of our producers, what's your name? Mark Skelton. I'm still in David.
Still out of space.
Yeah,
I'm still out
of space. I really
you're
am.
In a different dimension.
Exactly.
Maybe you're in the Twilight Zone.
I didn't even talk about the Twilight Zone.
You miss.
And I wanted to talk to him about the different dimensions and all that he writes about, in the holograms and all that. But in any event, at the moment we have Mark Skelton and the luminary of today.
Yes. Good evening. Thank you for that introduction, Philippa. Very kind. Today's luminary, his name is Will Allen, and he's a former pro basketball player, that's professional basketball player, and in 1993, he was shocked about the lack of, he actually called it the food desert, because the area where he came from, Park Lawn Housing Project, basically the biggest housing project in Milwaukee, and the whole area was just completely infested with fast food restaurants. And there was no fresh produce in the area. And basically what happened with him, there was only, and the problem was the residents didn't have cars. So they were stuck. So they really didn't have a choice to choose fresh, not even organic, but just fresh produce that they could eat and give their children and feed their families. And so Will Allen had a great idea, and he bought the last remaining farm in the area, renamed it Growing Power, and rejuvenated it as a food advocacy and educational nonprofit organization.
Wow.
Dedicated to getting fresh, locally grown food to the local residents. And that was back in 1993. And in the last 16 years, he's just gone from strength to strength. And what I really love about Will Allen's story is that he takes the local residents and he teaches them how to compost, how to grow their own food in their own backyards, how to really become self-sufficient. And that's really my point. That's what I love about Will Allen's story, is that he didn't rely on the government. He didn't rely on grants. He didn't rely on aid coming in. He didn't rely on somebody coming down and the hand of God saving them. He took the matter. He had a problem, and he solved it with his own hands.
In other words, one man can make a difference.
A difference. It's so true. You should trademark that saying. copyright. But basically, you can go to his website to find out more about this amazing project, and it is www.growingpower.org. That's O-R-G, growingpower.org. And I really urge you to be inspired, and if you have a similar situation in your area, follow in his footsteps. You know, his name is Will Allen, and really he is an inspiration and a guiding light to everybody. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Mark Skelton, for that. And, of course, thank you, Will Allen, and all the luminaries out there that we are talking about and the ones that we don't get an opportunity to talk about, because thankfully there are so many, and it's growing more and more. At least our awareness of them is, that's for sure. And speaking of luminaries, I consider Dorothy Lee one of our luminaries. She's also a producer. And here with another great message from us, the State of the Universe address.
Hi. Tonight I'm sharing with you a message that came to me in an email a few years ago. I'd like to thank the unknown author for stating absolute truths so simply and succinctly. The title of this essay is, What I Focus On Expands. I focus my energy on what I want, not on what I don't want. Whatever I place my attention on, I energize. Whatever I take my attention away from dissolves. I'm always at choice to where I fix my gaze. If something unwanted gets my attention, I quickly turn away and use my creative energy to focus on what I want instead. Words infused with good feelings and imagery generate the atmosphere in which I live, so I focus on words that increase feelings of well-being. We as a culture have been taught that the way to get what we want is to defeat what we don't want. However, the very thing I oppose is what I attract. So I focus on what I am for, not for what I'm against. Rather than fighting against poverty, I am for prosperity. Instead of guarding against a negative outcome, I am for a positive outcome. If doubt enters my consciousness, I focus on all the reasons I can achieve my desire. As I shift my focus to possibility thinking, any doubt is replaced with a feeling of confidence and an expanded awareness that all is well all the time. Therefore, I use my attention wisely and only focus on what I want. You can find this essay by going to our website, www.lifechangeswithfilippo.com, and click on the Life Changing Media tab in our navigation bar. Please do yourself a favor by printing this essay and display it in a place where you will be reminded of its powerful message. There is much chaos wherever we look these days, so it is more important than ever for us to be centered and grounded in unconditional love and absolute truth. Therefore, it is vital for us to focus on what we want, knowing that whatever we focus on expands because energy flows where our attention goes. So many of my clients have been asking me if pretending that all is good is just another form of denial, and I have to admit that this is a very good question. I truly believe that we are the co-creators of our lives, and I truly do believe and know that what I focus on expands. So the answer is simple. By acknowledging the negative information surrounding us and then putting our attention on the way we would like things to be is what we need to do to become conscious co-creators. To simply say that what appears to be reality, such as the negative aspects of life occurring all over the world, like famine, war, disease, worldwide financial collapse, overdue rent or mortgage payments, overdrawn bank accounts, credit card debt, etc., to say that this is not real is not going to get us to where we want to be. However, if we just acknowledge that the bank account may be overdrawn in this moment and then change our thoughts to how grateful we are that the rent or mortgage payment has been made, the car, cable, phone, gas, water, and electric bills are all current, and that there is good and healthy food in the house, and that there's plenty of gas in the cars, then we step out of the place of negativity into the attitude of gratitude. And this is where we need to be to co-create what we wish to see in the world. Please understand that I am not saying that this is easy to do, but I am saying that this is what we most must do. What is easy for us is to fall into old habits of mind that have been with us for generations. We must focus on the good in order to create more good. I admit that there are many moments, more than I am proud to confess, when I have slipped into the three-dimensional world as if it were ultimate reality. However, I have surrounded myself with my soul family and have enlisted each member to remind me when they see me operating at a less than optimal level of consciousness, and they are happy to do this favor for me. Just yesterday, I was reminded to think before I speak and make sure that I am connected before I answer a question. I had answered a question from a client just off the top of my head because I thought it was a silly question and the answer was not important to me. When the client wrote me the next day and told me that his friend was an expert in the field and was disappointed in my answer, I did what I could have done in the first place. Instead of giving a wrong answer, I could Google the question and answer correctly. And now I know, as much as I can know anything based on research, that stars are simply small suns because they're comprised of the same energies. I'm truly grateful to this client for reminding me to think before I speak and to make sure that I'm giving a correct answer to even the silliest questions. I also learned that what appeared to be silly to me was really important to him, and I apologized for my treatment of the question. Please join me in shifting our focus to possibility thinking and replacing any doubt with a feeling of confidence and truly know that all is well all of the time, no matter what it looks like in the first moment of observation. By choosing to live the truth of this essay every day of our lives, we are choosing to become conscious co-creators. And when we choose to live this profound message by putting it into action in our lives every single day, we can easily co-create the changes in the world we wish to see. By shifting our focus to the things we want instead of focusing on the negative that appears to be truth, we will co-create a world filled with love, peace, and abundance for all. Until next week, please choose to love yourself enough to make very conscious and elegant choices. And please know that you are loved, you are lovable, and you are loved.
Thank you, Dorothy Lee. You have been listening to Life Changes with Filippo. Join us here every Monday night at 9 p.m. Pacific Standard Time and visit us on the web at lifechangeswithfilippo.com. That's Filippo, F-I-L. So that's our show. And it's been very exciting and it's gone by so quickly. And it's probably because of what we talk about and how much fun we have talking about it. We have so much fun preparing for it and then so much fun afterwards talking about it. And usually the guest is here and we're taking pictures that you all probably see up on Facebook and we're having fun and it's just a great time. So with that, what can I say but to thank our guest, David Weddle, producer and writer, for for being with us today. I mean, really, he was just amazing, and he's so hard to nail down, and he's so busy, and we are so grateful that he chose to be on our particular show, and that has a lot to do with thanks to our producer Mark Skelton. So we thank him for being on our show, and we invite you to go to the archives if you've missed any part of this or you'd like to hear it again on our website, and click on the link to hear that show or this show or any other show, for that matter, that we've done already. So please do that, and let us know what you think. And we look forward to being together with you again on our next week when we're with the Green Children. Now, that's going to be exciting. The Green Children are a musical group who are so much more, have done so much, and can't wait to share with you exactly what they've done. They're actually going to be also with us during our live event. So if you go to our website, you will learn about them. And you can also come meet them live if you are local to the Los Angeles area. And someday soon, we'll be able to travel around to possibly where you are. Remember, you can keep the conversation going during the week by visiting us and writing us at our website at www.lifechangeswithfilippo.com. Of course, my name is spelled F-I-L-I-P-P-O. And connect with us on our Life Changes with Filippo Facebook fan page, or for that matter, any of our personal Facebook pages. Today's show has been made possible in part by our sponsors, IonWays Water Systems, Change Your Water, Change Your Life, and Love and Miracles. To learn more about them, visit our sponsor page on our website and click on their links. I am Filippo Voltaggio, and it has been my pleasure being of service by hosting Life Changes with Filippo today. I, along with our producers, Dorothy Lee, Mark Skelton, Mark Leger, and our engineer, Seth, thank you for joining us today and for joining us in being a part of this show and for being a part of the change we all wish to see in the world. Ciao.
You have been listening to Life Changes with Filippo. Join us here every Monday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And visit us on the web at lifechangeswithfilippo.com. That's Filippo, F-I-L-I-P-P-O.com. And follow our community on Facebook at Life Changes with Filippo. Join us here next week as we consciously embrace the only constant, life changes.